Continuing with 18th Brumaire, the condition of the French peasants provides us with the answer to the riddle of the general elections of December 20 and 21, which bore the second Bonaparte up Mount Sinai, not to receive laws, but to give them. Manifestly, the bourgeoisie had no choice but to elect Bonaparte. Only disorder can save order. And I comment here, I've been pondering in what sense the 18th Brumaire is class analysis and for whom it represents. As the word class itself serves power as both ideological tool and weapon, depending on one's relationship to Plato's tribesmen, i.e. that its reality is prescribed by those with the power to do so. And we the people have been silenced. And as those who speak officially speak falsely, and their public presentation is only so much role-playing, why does Marx take their speech for what they really think? And I'm asking that in particular in relation to what follows, continuing. As the executive authority which has made itself an independent power, Bonaparte feels it to be his mission to safeguard bourgeois order. But the strength of this bourgeois order lies in the middle class. He looks on himself, therefore, as the representative of the middle class and issues decrees in this sense. Nevertheless, he is somebody solely due to the fact that he has broken the political power of this middle class and daily breaks it anew. And that requires unpacking, I think, with Emmanuel Wallerstein once we get there. We'll revisit that thought with Emmanuel's help. Consequently, he looks on himself as the adversary of the political and literary power of the middle class, but by protecting its material power, he generates its political power anew. The cause must accordingly be kept alive, but the effect, where it manifests itself, must be done away with. But this cannot pass off without slight confusions of cause and effect, since in their interaction both lose their distinguishing feature. As against the bourgeoisie, Bonaparte looks on himself as the representative at the same time as the representative of the peasants and of the people in general. And recall my question, why does he take their speech for what they really think? This is, we're going to, again, when we read Emmanuel Wallerstein's chapter, revisit this whole set of assumptions that we are reading now from Marx. Continuing. But this cannot pass off, this trick of both destroying and regenerating its political power. But this cannot pass off without slight confusions of cause and effect, since in their interaction both lose their distinguishing features. As against the bourgeoisie, Bonaparte looks on himself at the same time as the representative of the peasants and of the people in general, who wants to make the lower classes of the people happy within the frame of bourgeois society. big qualification there, a tiny frame. But above all, Bonaparte looks on himself as the chief of the Society of December 10, as the representative of the lumpen proletariat to which he himself, his entourage, his government, and his army belong. And I would argue that above all, he looks on himself as the chief of these hidden power guys, or certainly their chief tool and weapon at the forefront of the imposition of their new global order. The representative, continuing, the representative of the lumpen, his entourage, his government, and his army belong, and whose prime consideration is to benefit itself and draw California lottery prizes from the state treasury. And he vindicates his position as chief of the Society of December 10, with decrees, without decrees, and despite decrees. This contradictory task of the man explains the contradictions of his government, the confused groping about. And again, we'll revisit this with Emmanuel Wallerstein. The confused groping about which seeks now to win now to humiliate first one class and then another, and to raise all of them uniformly against him, whose practice forms a highly comical contrast to the imperious, categorical style of the government decrees, a style which is faithfully copied from the uncle, Napoleon. Industry and trade, hence, the business affairs of the middle class are to prosper in hot house fashion under the strong government. The grant of innumerable railway concessions, but the Bonaparte lumpen proletariat is to enrich itself. The initiated play, tripotage, hanky-panky, tripotage, hanky-panky, on the bourse with the railway concessions. Leonine agreement of the bank with the government. The people are to be given employment, initiation of public works, dissolution of actual workers' associations, dissolution of actual workers' associations, but promises of miracles of association in the future. The peasants are to be helped, mortgage banks that expedite their getting into debt and accelerate the concentration of property, great help. But these banks are to be used to make money out of the confiscated estates of the House of Orléans. No capitalist wants to agree to this condition, which is not in the decree, and the mortgage bank remains a mere decree, etc., etc. So he's laying out this very complex set of events, all interweaving into, we will learn as we read Emanuel Wallerstein, a clear effect. Continuing, Bonaparte would like to appear as the patriarchal benefactor of all classes, but he cannot give to one class without taking from another, just as at the time of the Fronde it was said of the Duke of Guise that he was the most obligeant man in France because he had turned all his estates into his partisans' obligations to him. So Bonaparte would fain be the most obligeant man in France and turn all the property, all the labor of France into a personal obligation to himself. He would like to steal the whole of France in order to be able to make a present of her to France. Doesn't that sound familiar? That's a tactic we see around us constantly. The obligeant power guys, the graciousness of them in giving us a tiny crumb of what they've stolen from us so that we may be grateful and indebted. He would like to steal the whole of France in order to make a present of her to France. Or rather, in order to be able to buy France anew with French money. For as the chief of the Society of December 10, he must needs buy what ought to belong to him. You see the power of Marx. He's so articulate. He's so brilliant. But he's got those blind spots, don't he? And all the state institutions, the Senate, the Council of State, the legislative body, the Legion of Honor, the soldiers' medals, the wash houses, the public works, the railways, the Etat Major, general staff of the National Guard to the exclusion of privates, and the confiscated estates of the House of Orléans, all become parts of the institution of purchase. Every place in the army and in the government machine becomes a means of purchase. But the most important feature of this process, whereby France is taken in order to give to her, is the percentages that find their way into the pockets of the head and the members of the Society of December 10, i.e. hidden power during the turnover. My comment on this: the shadow state needs shadow troops with shadow orders that they execute. When power wants to operate extra legally, they convene impromptu December 10 societies. And next week we will read Marx's description of this original December 10 society. We see current iterations all around us as I speak. Thank you so much, as always, for loving, Trying to get through here, I'm sorry. Thank you, as always, for listening. And as always, I love you. Until next week, peace.